For Schopenhauer, these different aspects of the world do not have equal roles in answering our metaphysical queries about existence. The ultimate reality is the will. Schopenhauer praises the will, and he uses the terms of adulation philosophers have traditionally bestowed upon whatever is most real. The will is a primal unity that underlies and expresses itself throughout all nature. The will is being, unity, and reality. On the other hand, the world of appearances is becoming, plurality, and illusion. Though Schopenhauer starts from the Kantian view that the thing in itself is unknowable, he nevertheless arrives at the contrary opinion. We know the will immediately and absolutely through our own individual will, its desires and strivings. The will, which each man finds in himself, is the same will that manifests itself in every living thing and in all the forces of nature.
But this word, will, which, like a magic word, is to reveal to us the innermost essence of everything in nature, by no means expresses an unknown quantity, something reached by inferences and syllogisms, but something known absolutely and immediately, and that so well that we know and understand what will is better than anything else, be it what it may.
When Schopenhauer says that the will reveals the innermost essence of everything in nature, we should bear in mind that the will is a single metaphysical reality. This doesn't mean that the will of one man is exactly the same as the will of another. It doesn't mean that one woman experiences what another woman wills. Schopenhauer believes that our experience of our own will serves as a sort of window looking into the will. We all experience the same will in much the same way that several people standing at different windows can all look into the same house. Schopenhauer says our individual wills appear separate because plurality governs the visible world. When the will manifests itself in the world of appearances, it necessarily appears as many individual wills. For Schopenhauer, the will underlies all the different appearances of the will. It is not merely an abstraction from individual wills. For example, the will is not a political notion, similar to Rousseau's idea of the general will. In his work, The Social Contract, Rousseau assumes that society is composed of a group, each of whom has an individual will. For Rousseau, the general will is an abstraction describing an agreement among individuals, an agreement to preserve the good of all. In creating a social contract, Rousseau says the members of the community join their individual wills together.
Immediately, in place of the individual person of each contracting party, this act of association creates an artificial and collective body composed of as many members as there are voters in the assembly. And by this same act, that body acquires its unity, its common ego, its life, and its will.
For Rousseau, the notion of a general will comes after the individual wills of the people in the society. The will, in Schopenhauer's sense of the word, exists before all individual expressions of will. In Schopenhauer's philosophy, the will is the central concept for understanding the world. But the world as representation is also important. Schopenhauer actually opens his work, The World as Will and Representation, with a section on the world as representation. He believes the visible world of appearances is much more familiar than the hidden reality of the will. For Schopenhauer, the world is our representation. He follows Kant in arguing that the mind actively shapes the world we experience through our senses, so our world wholly depends on our perception of it.
The world is my representation, is like the axioms of Euclid, a proposition which everyone must recognize as true as soon as he understands it, although it is not a proposition that everyone understands as soon as he hears it.
Schopenhauer believes this idea is valid for every living, knowing being. To say the world is representation means that the world's existence depends upon conscious beings who perceive it. Apart from beings who perceive it, the world as representation has no reality. Schopenhauer proposes three categories which the mind uses to organize our experience: space, time, and causality. The mind turns bare sensation into meaningful perception using the categories. Without space, time, and causality, we would have only data conveyed from the senses to the brain. This data would be utterly without form or meaning. We would have no experience at all. Furthermore, according to Schopenhauer, we can't say that a material world exists independently of our minds because matter itself is not sensed directly. We perceive matter only by applying the three fundamental categories.
But as with the appearance of the sun, the visible world makes its appearance, so at one stroke does the understanding, through its one simple function, convert dull, meaningless sensation into perception. But the eye, ear, or the hand experience is not perception. It is mere data. Only by the passing of the understanding from the effect to the cause does the world stand out as perception extended in space, varying with respect to form, persisting through all time as regards matter. For the understanding unites space and time in the representation of matter, that is to say, effectiveness. This world, as representation, exists only through the understanding, and also for the understanding.
Schopenhauer's argument that the world as representation depends on the perceiver may seem to impugn the reality of the world. Schopenhauer agrees that making the world dependent on the minds of conscious observers puts the world on the same level as ideas, a view called idealism. But this view doesn't deny that the world is real. For Schopenhauer, the world is real, not because it exists independently of our minds, but rather because we perceive it in space and time.
The whole world of objects is and remains representation, and is for this reason wholly and forever conditioned by the subject. In other words, it has transcendental ideality. But it is not on that account falsehood or illusion. To dispute about its reality can occur only to a mind perverted by over-subtle sophistry.
Although the world as representation is conditioned by the observing subject, this is a far cry from saying that the world is created by the subject. That would be the same as saying that the world is a fiction the mind produces. The world's dependence on the subject does not make it any less real, nor is the world any less a source of suffering or anxiety. Schopenhauer himself was ever watchful for imminent disaster. He took inordinate precautions against disease. He frequently carried about his own drinking cup to avoid contagion. He feared nighttime intruders so much that he slept with a loaded pistol by his bed. He was continually uneasy and fitful about what unpleasant event might occur next. Schopenhauer once observed,
"If I have nothing that alarms me, I grow alarmed at this very condition, as if there must still be something of which I am only ignorant for a time."
Schopenhauer tried to distance himself from his contemporaries, but his idealist description of the world as representation placed him within the tradition of German idealism. Let's look briefly at the versions of idealism offered by Schopenhauer's contemporaries. Johann Gottlieb Fichte and Friedrich Schelling. We'll then have a better idea of how Schopenhauer's version of idealism is distinct. Schopenhauer believes that the world is conditioned by the mind through the categories of space, time, and causality. He does not think that the objective reality of the world is created by the mind. According to Fichte, however, the mind is the absolute principle of reality. The mind produces the world from itself. Fichte does not place this burden of creating the world on an individual mind. Rather, he refers to an absolute thinking self. In an original creative act, the absolute self produced the world in accordance with the laws of space, time, and causality. In Fichte's philosophy, experience thus derives from the free creative activity of the absolute self.
We know well enough that the thing comes into being purely through an action in accord with these laws. That it is nothing else but the totality of these relations unified by the imagination, and that all these relations together constitute the thing. The object is surely the original synthesis of all these concepts.